For the New Intellectual by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 2. What philosophy was offering them as interpretation of and guidance for their achievements was the plain witch doctory of Hegel, who proclaimed that matter does not exist at all, that everything is idea, not somebody's idea, just idea, and that this idea operates by the dialectical process of a new super-logic, which proves that contradictions are the law of reality, that A is non-A, and that omniscience about the physical universe, including electricity, gravitation, the solar system, etc., is to be derived not from the observation of facts, but from the contemplation of that idea's triple somersaults inside his, Hegel's, mind. This was offered as a philosophy of reason. While businessmen were rising to spectacular achievements of creative ability and self-confidently ambitious courage, challenging the primordial dogma of man's poverty and misery on earth, breaking open the trade routes of the world, releasing mankind's productive energy and placing in its service the liberating power of machines, against the scornful resistance of loafing ex-feudal aristocrats and the destructive violence of those who were to profit most, the workers, what philosophy was offering as an evaluation of their achievements and as guidance for the rest of society was the pure Attilaism of Marx, who proclaimed that the mind does not exist, that everything is matter, that matter develops itself by the dialectical process of its own super logic of contradictions, and what is true today will not be true tomorrow, that the material tools of production determine men's ideological superstructure, which means machines create men's thinking, not the other way around, that muscular labor is the source of wealth, that physical force is the only practical means of existence, and that the seizure of the omnipotent machines will transfer omnipotence to the rule of brute violence. Never had Attila's psycho-epistemology been transcribed so accurately. This was offered as a philosophy of history and of political economy. What was offered as philosophical antidote to those who would not accept these theories? As a defense against the witch doctory of Kant and Hegel, the businessman was offered the neo-mystic Attilaism of the pragmatists. They declared that philosophy must be practical, and that practicality consists of dispensing with all absolute principles and standards, that there is no such thing as objective reality or permanent truth, that truth is that which works, and its validity can be judged only by its consequences, that no facts can be known with certainty in advance, and anything may be tried by rule of thumb, that reality is not firm, but fluid and indeterminate, that there is no such thing as a distinction between an external world and a consciousness, between the perceived and the perceiver. There is only an undifferentiated package deal labeled experience, and whatever one wishes to be true is true. Whatever one wishes to exist does exist, provided it works or makes one feel better. A later school of more Kantian pragmatists amended this philosophy as follows. If there is no such thing as an objective reality, men's metaphysical choice is whether the selfish, dictatorial whims of an individual or the democratic whims of a collective are to shape that plastic goo which the ignorant call reality. Therefore, this school decided that objectivity consists of collective subjectivism, that knowledge is to be gained by means of public polls among special elites of competent investigators who can predict and control reality, that whatever people wish to be true is true, whatever people wish to exist does exist, and anyone who holds any firm convictions of his own is an arbitrary mystic dogmatist, since reality is indeterminate and people determine its actual nature. The scientist was offered a slightly different version of philosophy. As a defense against the witch doctory of Hegel, who claimed universal omniscience, The scientist was offered the combined neo-mystic witch doctory and Attilaism of the logical positivists. They assured him that such concepts as metaphysics or existence or reality or thing or matter or mind are meaningless. Let the mystics care whether they exist or not. A scientist does not have to know it. The task of theoretical science is the manipulation of symbols, and scientists are the special elite whose symbols have the magic power of making reality conform to their will. Matter is that which fits mathematical equations. Knowledge, they said, consists not of facts, but of words. Words unrelated to objects. Words of an arbitrary social convention as an irreducible primary. Thus, knowledge is merely a matter of manipulating language. The job of scientists, they said, is not the study of reality, but the creation of arbitrary constructs by means of arbitrary sounds, and any construct is as valid as another, since the criterion of validity is only convenience, and the definition of science is that which the scientists do. But this omnipotent power, surpassing the dreams of ancient numerologists or of medieval alchemists, was granted to the scientist by philosophical Attilaism on two conditions. A. That he never claims certainty for his knowledge, since certainty is unknowable to man, and that he claim instead percentages of probability, not troubling himself with such questions as how one calculates percentages of the unknowable. B. That he claim as absolute knowledge the proposition that all values lie outside the sphere of science, that reason is impotent to deal with morality, that moral values are a matter of subjective choice, dictated by one's feelings, not one's mind. The great treason of the philosophers was that they never stepped out of the Middle Ages. They never challenged the witch doctor's code of morality. They were willing to doubt the existence of physical objects. They were willing to doubt the validity of their own senses. They were willing to defy the authority of absolute monarchies. They were willing, occasionally, to proclaim themselves to be skeptics or agnostics or atheists. But they were not willing to doubt the doctrine that man is a sacrificial animal, that he has no right to exist for his own sake, that service to others is the only justification of his existence, and that self-sacrifice is his highest moral duty, virtue, and value. Under all its countless guises, variations, and adaptations, that doctrine, best designated as the morality of altruism, has come from prehistoric swamps to New York City, unchanged. In savage societies, men practiced the ritual of human sacrifices, immolating individual men on sacrificial altars for the sake of what they regarded as their collective tribal good. Today, they are still doing it. Only the agony is slower and the slaughter greater. But the doctrine that demands it and sanctions it is the same doctrine of moral cannibalism. The philosophers preserved it by leaving the subject of morality to the mystics, or by consigning it to the province of subjective feelings, which means to the mystics, or by the vehement rejection of reason's capacity to deal with moral values, and the branding of all value judgments as unscientific, which means the reaffirmation and perpetuation of the mystics' monopoly on morality. Or worst of all, by accepting the mystics' moral code in its irrational entirety, then translating it into earthly terms and propagating it in the name of reason. The convolutions of this last attempt provide what is perhaps the most grotesquely terrible chapter in the history of Western thought. The political me-tooism, abjectly displayed by the conservatives of today toward their brazenly socialistic adversaries, is only the result and the feeble reflection of the ethical me-tooism displayed by the philosophers of the 19th and 20th centuries, by the alleged champions of reason toward the witch-doctors of morality. Auguste Comte, the founder of positivism, the champion of science, advocated a rational, scientific social system based on the total subjugation of the individual to the collective, including a religion of humanity which substituted society for the gods or gods who collect the blood of sacrificial victims. It is not astonishing that Comte was the coiner of the term altruism, which means the placing of others above self, of their interests above one's own. Nietzsche's rebellion against altruism consisted of replacing the sacrifice of oneself to others by the sacrifice of others to oneself. He proclaimed that the ideal man is moved not by reason but by his blood, by his innate instincts, feelings, and will to power, that he is predestined by birth to rule others and sacrifice them to himself, while they are predestined by birth to be his victims and slaves, that reason, logic, principles are futile and debilitating, that morality is useless, that the Superman is beyond good and evil, that he is a beast of prey whose ultimate standard is nothing but his own whim. Thus, Nietzsche's rejection of the witch doctor consisted of elevating Attila into a moral ideal, which meant a double surrender of morality to the witch doctor. Jeremy Bentham, the champion of capitalism, defended it by proclaiming the greatest happiness of the greatest number as its moral justification, and propounded a hedonistic calculus for men's moral guidance, which enunciated the principle that before taking any action, one must consider all the possible forms and amounts of happiness and unhappiness to accrue to all the people possibly to be affected by the consequences of one's action, including oneself as one unit among the dozens or hundreds or millions. One must compute them all, then act accordingly and sacrifice the hedonistic minority to the majority. Herbert Spencer, another champion of capitalism, chose to decide that the theory of evolution and of adaptation to environment was the key to man's morality, and declared that the moral justification of capitalism was the survival of the species, of the human race, that whoever was of no value to the race had to perish, that man's morality consisted of adapting oneself to one's social environment and seeking one's own happiness in the welfare of society, and that the automatic processes of evolution would eventually obliterate the distinction between selfishness and unselfishness. And when Karl Marx, the most consistent translator of the altruist morality into practical action and political theory, advocated a society where all would be sacrificed to all, starting with the immediate immolation of the able, the intelligent, the successful, and the wealthy, whatever opposition he did encounter, nobody opposed him on moral grounds. Predominantly, he was granted the status of a noble but impractical idealist. The great treason of the philosophers was that they, the thinkers, defaulted on the responsibility of providing a rational society with a code of rational morality. They, whose job it was to discover and define man's moral values, stared at the brilliant torrent of man's released energy and had nothing better to offer for its guidance than the witch doctor's morality of human sacrifices, of self-denial, self-abasement, self-immolation, of suffering, guilt, and death. The failure of philosophers to challenge the witch doctor's morality has cost them their kingdom, philosophy. The relationship of reason and morality is reciprocal. The man who accepts the role of a sacrificial animal will not achieve the self-confidence necessary to uphold the validity of his mind. The man who doubts the validity of his mind will not achieve the self-esteem necessary to uphold the value of his person and to discover the moral premises that make man's value possible. The intellectuals share the philosopher's guilt. The intellectuals, all those whose professions deal with the humanities and require a firm philosophical base, have known for a long time that no such base existed. They knew that they were functioning in a philosophical vacuum, and that the currency they were passing was rubber checks which would bounce someday, wrecking their culture. One can never know, only surmise, what tragedies, despair, and silent devastation have been going on for over a century in the invisible underground of the intellectual professions, in the souls of their practitioners, nor what incalculable potential of human ability and integrity perished in those hidden, lonely conflicts. The young minds who came to the field of the intellect with the inarticulate sense of a crusade, seeking rational answers to the problems of achieving a meaningful human existence, found a philosophical con game in place of guidance and leadership. Some of them gave up the field of ideas in hopeless, indignant frustration and vanished into the silence of subjectivity. Others gave in and saw their eagerness turn into bitterness, their quest into apathy, their crusade into a cynical racket. They condemned themselves to the chronic anxiety of a con man, dreading exposure when they accepted the roles of enlightened leaders, while knowing that their knowledge rested on nothing but fog, and that its only validation was somebody's feelings. They, the standard-bearers of the mind, found themselves dreading reason as an enemy, logic as a pursuer, thought as an avenger. They, the proponents of ideas, found themselves clinging to the belief that ideas were impotent. Their choice was the futility of a charlatan or the guilt of a traitor. They were not mediocrities when they began their careers. They were pretentious mediocrities when they ended. The exceptions are growing rarer with every generation. No one can accept with psychological impunity the function of a witch doctor under the banner of the intellect. With nothing but quicksands to stand on, the shifting mixture of witch-doctory and Attilaism as their philosophical base, the intellectuals were unable to grasp, to identify, or to evaluate the historical drama taking place before them, the Industrial Revolution and capitalism. They were like men who did not see the splendor of a rocket bursting over their heads because their eyes were lowered in guilt. It was their job to see and to explain to a society of men stumbling dazedly out of a primeval dungeon the cause and the meaning of the events that were sweeping them faster and farther than the motion of all the centuries behind them. The intellectuals did not choose to see. The men in the other professions were not able to step back and observe. If some men found themselves leaving their farms for a chance to work in a factory, that was all they knew. If their children now had a chance to survive beyond the age of 10, child mortality had been about 50% in the pre-capitalist era, they were not able to identify the cause. They could not tell why the periodic famines that had been striking every 20 years to wipe out the surplus population, which pre-capitalist economies could not feed, now came to an end, as did the carnages of religious wars. Nor why fears seemed to be lifting away from people's voices and from the streets of growing cities, nor why an enormous exultation was suddenly sweeping the world. The intellectuals did not choose to tell them. The intellectuals, or their predominant majority, remained centuries behind their time. Still seeking the favor of noble protectors, some of them were bewailing the vulgarity of commercial pursuits, scoffing at those whose wealth was new, and simultaneously blaming these new wealth-makers for all the poverty inherited from the centuries ruled by the owners of nobly non-commercial wealth. Others were denouncing machines as inhuman and factories as a blemish on the beauty of the countryside, where gallows had formerly stood at the crossroads. Still others were calling for a movement back to nature, to the handicrafts, to the Middle Ages, and some were attacking scientists for inquiring into forbidden mysteries and interfering with God's design. The victim of the intellectual's most infamous injustice was the businessman. Having accepted the premises, the moral values, and the position of witch doctors, the intellectuals were unwilling to differentiate between the businessman and Attila, between the producer of wealth and the looter. Like the witch doctor, they scorned and dreaded the realm of material reality, feeling secretly inadequate to deal with it. Like the witch doctors, their secret vision, almost their feared and envied ideal of a practical, successful man, a true master of reality, was Attila. Like the witch doctor, they believed that force, fraud, lies, plunder, expropriation, enslavement, murder were practical. So they did not inquire into the source of wealth or ever ask what made it possible. They had been taught that causality is an illusion and that only the immediate moment is real. They took it as their axiom, as an irreducible primary, that wealth can be acquired only by force, and that a fortune as such is the proof of plunder, with no further distinctions or inquiries necessary. With their eyes still fixed on the Middle Ages, they were maintaining this in the midst of a period when a greater amount of wealth than had ever before existed in the world was being brought into existence all around them. If the men who produced that wealth were thieves, from whom had they stolen it? Under all the shameful twists of their evasions, the intellectuals' answer was, from those who had not produced it. They were refusing to acknowledge the Industrial Revolution. They are still refusing today. They were refusing to admit into their universe what neither Attila nor the witch doctor can afford to admit, the existence of man the producer. Evading the difference between production and looting, they called the businessman a robber. Evading the difference between freedom and compulsion, they called him a slave driver. Evading the difference between reward and terror, they called him an exploiter. Evading the difference between paychecks and guns, they called him an autocrat. Evading the difference between trade and force, they called him a tyrant. The most crucial issue they had to evade was the difference between the earned and the unearned. Ignoring the existence of the faculty they were betraying, the faculty of discrimination, the intellect, they refused to identify the fact that industrial wealth was the product of man's mind, that an incalculable amount of intellectual power, of creative intelligence, of disciplined energy, of human genius had gone into the creation of industrial fortunes. They could not afford to identify it because they could not afford to admit the fact that the intellect is a practical faculty, a guide to man's successful existence on earth, and that its task is the study of reality as well as the production of wealth, not the contemplation of unintelligible feelings, nor a special monopoly on the unknowable. The witch doctor's morality of altruism, the morality that damns all those who achieve success or enjoyment on earth, provided the intellectuals with the means to make a virtue of evasion. It gave them a weapon that disarmed their victims. It gave them an automatic substitute for self-esteem and a chance at an unearned moral stature. They proclaimed themselves to be the defenders of the poor against the rich, righteously evading the fact that the rich were not Attila's any longer, and the defenders of the weak against the strong, righteously evading the fact that the strength involved was not the strength of brute muscles any longer, but the strength of man's mind. But while the intellectuals regarded the businessman as Attila, the businessman would not behave as they, from the position of witch doctors, expected Attila to behave. He was impervious to their power. The businessman was as bewildered by events as the rest of mankind. He had no time to grasp his own historical role. He had no moral weapons, no voice, no defense. And knowing no morality but the altruist code, yet knowing also that he was functioning against it, that self-sacrifice was not his role, he was helplessly vulnerable to the intellectuals' attack. He would have welcomed eagerly the guidance of Aristotle, but had no use for Immanuel Kant. That which today is called common sense is the remnant of an Aristotelian influence, and that was the businessman's only form of philosophy. The businessman asked for proof and expected things to make sense, an expectation that kicked the intellectuals into the category of the unemployed. They had nothing to offer to a man who did not buy any shares of any version of the noumenal world. To understand the course the intellectuals chose to take, it is important to remember the witch doctor's psycho-epistemology and his relationship to Attila. The witch doctor expects Attila to be his protector against reality, against the necessity of rational cognition, and at the same time he expects to rule his own protector, who needs an unintelligible mystic sanction as a narcotic to relieve his chronic guilt. They derive their mutual security not from any form of strength, but from the fact that each has a hold on the other's secret weakness. It is not the security of two traders, who count on the values they offer each other, but the security of two blackmailers who count on each other's fear. The witch doctor feels like a metaphysical outcast in a capitalist society, as if he were pushed into some limbo outside of any universe he cares to recognize. He has no means to deal with innocence. He can get no hold on a man who does not seek to live in guilt, on a businessman who is confident of his ability to earn his living, who takes pride in his work and in the value of his product, who drives himself with inexhaustible energy and limitless ambition to do better and still better and ever better, who is willing to bear penalties for his mistakes and expects rewards for his achievements, who looks at the universe with the fearless eagerness of a child, knowing it to be intelligible, who demands straight lines, clear terms, precise definitions, who stands in full sunlight and has no use for the murky fog of the hidden, the secret, the unnamed, the furtively evocative, for any code of signals from the psycho-epistemology of guilt. What the businessman offered to the intellectuals was the spiritual counterpart of his own activity, that which the witch doctor dreads most, the freedom of the marketplace of ideas. To live by the work of one's mind, to offer men the products of one's thinking, to provide them with new knowledge, to stand on nothing but the merit of one's ideas, and to rely on nothing but objective truth, in a market open to any man who is willing to think, and has to judge, accept, or reject on his own, is a task that only a man on the conceptual level of psycho-epistemology can welcome or fulfill. It is not the place for a witch doctor, nor for any mystic elite. A witch doctor has to live by the favor of a protector, by a special dispensation, by a reserved monopoly, by exclusion, by suppression, by censorship. Having accepted the philosophy and the psycho-epistemology of the witch doctor, the intellectuals had to cut the ground from under their own feet and turn against their own historical distinction. Against the first chance men had ever had to make a professional living by means of the intellect. When the intellectuals rebelled against the commercialism of a capitalist society, what they were specifically rebelling against was the open market of ideas, where feelings were not accepted and ideas were expected to demonstrate their validity, where the risks were great, injustices were possible, and no protector existed but objective reality. Just as Attila, since the Renaissance, was looking for a witch doctor of his own, so the intellectuals, since the Industrial Revolution, were looking for an Attila of their own. The altruist morality brought them together and gave them the weapon they needed. The field where they found each other was socialism. It was not the businessmen, or the industrialists, or the workers, or the labor unions, or the remnants of the feudal aristocracy that began the revolt against freedom and the demand for the return of the absolute state. It was the intellectuals. It was the alleged guardians of reason who brought mankind back to the rule of brute force. Growing throughout the 19th century, originated in and directed from intellectual salons, sidewalk cafes, basement beer joints, and university classrooms, the industrial counter-revolution united the witch doctors and the Attilaists. They demanded the right to enforce ideas at the point of a gun, that is, through the power of government, and compel the submission of others to the views and wishes of those who would gain control of the government's machinery. They extolled the state as the form of the good, with man as its abject servant, and they proposed as many variants of the socialist state as there had been of the altruist morality. But in both cases, the variations merely played with the surface, while the cannibal essence remained the same. Socialism is the doctrine that man has no right to exist for his own sake, that his life and his work do not belong to him, but belong to society, that the only justification of his existence is his service to society, and that society may dispose of him in any way it pleases for the sake of whatever it deems to be its own tribal collective good. It is only the Attilaist, pragmatist, positivist, anti-conceptual mentality, which grants no validity to abstractions, no meaning to principles, and no power to ideas, that can still wonder why a theoretical doctrine of that kind had to lead in practice to the torrent of blood and brute non-human horror of such socialist societies as Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. Only the Attilaist mentality can still claim that nobody can prove that these had to be the necessary results, or still try to blame it on the imperfection of human nature or on the evil of some specific gang who betrayed a noble ideal, and still promise that its own gang would do it better and make it work, or still mumble in a quavering voice that the motive was love of humanity. The pretenses have worn thin. The evasions do not work any longer. The intellectuals are aware of their guilt, but are still struggling to evade its cause and to pass it on to the universe at large, to man's metaphysically predestined impotence. Guilt and fear are the disintegrators of a man's consciousness or of a society's culture. Today, America's culture is being splintered into disintegration by the three injunctions which permeate our intellectual atmosphere and which are typical of guilt. Don't look. Don't judge. Don't be certain. The psycho-epistemological meaning and implementation of these three are don't integrate, don't evaluate, give up. The last stand of Attilaism, both in philosophy and in science, is the concerted assertion of all the neo-mystics that integration is impossible and unscientific. The escape from the conceptual level of consciousness, the progressive contraction of man's vision down to Attila's range, has now reached its ultimate climax. Withdrawing from reality and responsibility, the neo-mystics proclaim that no entities exist, only relationships, and that one may study relationships without anything to relate. And simultaneously, that every datum is single and discrete, and no datum can ever be related to any other data. That context is irrelevant, that anything may be proved or disproved in mid-air and midstream, and the narrower the subject of study, the better. That myopia is the hallmark of a thinker or a scientist. System building, the integration of knowledge into a coherent sum and a consistent view of reality, is denounced by all the Attilaists as irrational, mystical, and unscientific. This is Attila's perennial way of surrendering to the witch doctor, and it explains why so many scientists are turning to God, or to such flights of mysticism of their own as would make even an old-fashioned witch doctor blush. No consciousness can accept disintegration as a normal and permanent state. Science was born as a result and consequence of philosophy. It cannot survive without a philosophical, particularly epistemological, base. If philosophy perishes, science will be next to go. The abdication of philosophy is all but complete. Today's philosophers, qua witch doctors, declare that nobody can define what is philosophy or what is its specific task, but this need not prevent anyone from practicing it as a profession. Qua Attilaists, they declare that the use of wide abstractions or concepts is the prerogative of the layman or of the ignorant or of the man in the street, while a philosopher is one who, knowing all the difficulties involved in the problem of abstractions, deals with nothing but concretes. The injunction, don't judge, is the ultimate climax of the altruist morality, which today can be seen in its naked essence. When men plead for forgiveness, for the nameless, cosmic forgiveness of an unconfessed evil, when they react with instantaneous compassion to any guilt, to the perpetrators of any atrocity, while turning away indifferently from the bleeding bodies of the victims and the innocent, one may see the actual purpose, motive, and psychological appeal of the altruist code. When these same compassionate men turn with snarling hatred upon anyone who pronounces moral judgments, when they scream that the only evil is the determination to fight against evil, one may see the kind of moral blank check that the altruist morality hands out. Perhaps the most craven attitude of all is the one expressed by the injunction, "Don't be certain." As stated explicitly by many intellectuals, it is the suggestion that if nobody is certain of anything, if nobody holds any firm convictions, if everybody is willing to give in to everybody else, no dictator will rise among us and we will escape the destruction sweeping the rest of the world. This is the secret voice of the witch doctor, confessing that he sees a dictator, an Attila, as a man of confident strength and uncompromising conviction. Nothing but a psycho-epistemological panic can blind such intellectuals to the fact that a dictator, like any thug, runs from the first sign of confident resistance, that he can rise only in a society of precisely such uncertain, compliant, shaking compromisers as they advocate a society that invites a thug to take over, and that the task of resisting an Attila can be accomplished only by men of intransigent conviction and moral certainty, not by chickens hiding their heads in the sand. Ostrich is too big and dignified a metaphor for this instance. And paving the way for Attila, the intellectuals are still repeating, not by conviction any longer, but by rote, that the growth of government power is not an abridgment of freedom, that the demand of one group for an unearned share of another group's income is not socialism, that the destruction of property rights will not affect any other rights, that man's mind, intelligence, creative ability are a national resource, like mines, forests, waterfalls, buffalo reserves, and national parks, to be taken over, subsidized, and disposed of by the government. That businessmen are selfish autocrats because they are struggling to preserve freedom, while the liberals are the true champions of liberty because they are fighting for more government controls. That the fact that we are sliding down a road which has destroyed every other country does not prove that it will destroy ours. That dictatorship is not dictatorship if nobody calls it by that abstract name, and that none of us can help it anyway. Nobody believes any of it any longer, yet nobody opposes it. To oppose anything, one needs a firm set of principles, which means a philosophy. If America perishes, it will perish by intellectual default. There is no diabolical conspiracy to destroy it. No conspiracy could be big enough and strong enough. Such cafeteria socialist conspiracies, as do undoubtedly exist, are groups of scared, neurotic mediocrities who find themselves pushed into national leadership because nobody else steps forward. They are like pickpockets who merely intended to snatch a welfare regulation or two, and who suddenly find that their victim is unconscious, that they are alone in an enormous mansion of fabulous wealth, with all the doors open and a seasoned burglar's job on their hands. Watch them now screaming that they didn't mean it, that they had never advocated the nationalization of a country's economy. As to the communist conspirators in the service of Soviet Russia, they are the best illustration of victory by default. Their successes were handed to them by the concessions of their victims. There is no national movement for socialism or dictatorship in America, no man on horseback or popular demagogue, nothing but fumbling compromisers and frightened opportunists. Yet we are moving toward full totalitarian socialism, with worn, cynical voices telling us that such is the irresistible trend of history. History, fate, and malevolent conspiracy are easier to believe than the actual truth, that we are moved by nothing but the sluggish inertia of unfocused minds. Collectivism as a social ideal is dead, but capitalism has not yet been discovered. It cannot be discovered by the psycho-epistemology of witch doctors and Attilaists, and as to the businessman, he is struggling to forget that he had ever known it. That is his guilt. The businessman historically had started as the victim of the intellectuals, But no injustice or exploitation can succeed for long without the sanction of the victim. The businessman who could not accept the intellectual leadership of post-Kantian witch doctors made his fatal error when he conceded to them the field of the intellect. He gave them the benefit of the doubt at his own expense. He concluded that their meaningless verbiage could not be as bad as it sounded to him, that he lacked understanding but had no stomach for trying to understand that sort of stuff, and would leave it respectfully alone. No witch doctor could have hoped for a deadlier concession. By becoming anti-intellectual, the businessman condemned himself to the position of an Attila. By restricting his goals, concerns, and vision exclusively to his specific productive activity, he was forced to restrict his interests to Attila's narrow range of the physical, the material, the immediately present. Thus he tore himself in two by an inner contradiction. He functioned on a confidently rational, conceptual level of psychoepistemology in business, but repressed all the other aspects of his life and thought, letting himself be carried passively along by the general cultural current in the semi-unfocused, perceptual-level daze of a man who considers himself impotent to judge what he perceives. It is thus that he turned too often into the tragic phenomenon of a genius in business who is a babbit in his private life. He repressed and renounced any interest in ideas, any quest for intellectual values or moral principles. He could not accept the altruist morality, as no man of self-esteem can accept it. And he found no other moral philosophy. He lived by a subjective code of his own, the code of justice, the code of a fair trader, without knowing what a superlative moral virtue it represented. His private version or understanding of altruism, particularly in America, took the form of an enormous generosity, the joyous, innocent, benevolent generosity of a self-confident man who is too innocent to suspect that he is hated for his success, that the moralists of altruism want him to pay financial tributes, not as kindness but as atonement for the guilt of having succeeded. There were exceptions. There were businessmen who did accept the full philosophical meaning of altruism and its ugly burden of guilt. But they were not the majority. They are the majority today. No man or group of men can live indefinitely under the pressure of moral injustice. They have to rebel or give in. Most of the businessmen gave in. It would have taken a philosopher to provide them with the intellectual weapons of rebellion, but they had given up any interest in philosophy. They accepted the burden of an unearned guilt. They accepted the brand of vulgar materialists. They accepted the accusations of predatory greed, predatory toward the wealth which they had created, greed for the fortunes which but for them would not have existed. As a result, consciously or subconsciously, they were driven to the cynical bitterness of the conviction that men are irrational, that reason is impotent in human relationships, that the field of ideas is some dark, gigantic, incomprehensible fraud. No one can accept unearned guilt with psychological impunity. Starting as the most courageous class of men in history, the businessmen have slipped slowly into the position of men motivated by chronic fear in all the social, political, moral, intellectual aspects of their existence. Their public policy consists of appeasing their worst enemies, placating their most contemptible attackers, trying to make terms with their own destroyers, pouring money into the support of leftist publications and liberal politicians, placing avowed collectivists in charge of their public relations, and then voicing in banquet speeches and full-page ads socialistic protestations that selfless service to society is their only goal, and altruistic apologies for the fact that they still keep 2 or 3% of profit out of their multi-million-dollar enterprises. There are many different motives behind that policy. Some men are moved by actual guilt. They are the new type of businessmen, the product of a mixed economy, who make fortunes not by productive ability and competition in a free market, but by political pull, by government favors, subsidies, franchises, and special privileges. These are psycho-epistemologically and economically closer to Attila than to the producer and have good reason to feel guilty. Others are forced reluctantly into a mixed position, where they still live by productive ability, yet have to depend on government favors in order to function. These are the closest to the position of self-destroyers. The majority of businessmen, perhaps the ablest and best, work in silence and are never heard from publicly. Most businessmen have probably given up the expectation of any justice from the public. But there is one motive which is shared by too many businessmen, and which is the penalty for renouncing the intellect. An unconfessed fear of ideas, under the professed conviction that ideas are futile, which leads to a nervously stubborn evasiveness, an anxious feeling or hope that wealth as such is power, that only material possessions are of practical importance. Today the businessman and the intellectual face each other with the mutual fear and the mutual contempt of Attila and the witch doctor. The businessman has lost confidence in all theories and functions on a range-of-the-moment expediency, not daring to look at the future. The intellectual has cut himself off from reality and plays a futile word game with ideas, not daring to look at the past. The businessman considers the intellectual impractical. The intellectual considers the businessman immoral. But secretly, each of them believes that the other possesses a mysterious faculty he lacks, that the other is the true master of reality, the true exponent of the power to deal with existence. It is by this mutual attitude, and the philosophical premises from which it comes, that they are destroying each other. The major share of the guilt belongs to the intellectual. Philosophical leadership was his responsibility, which he betrayed and is now deserting under fire. The most grotesquely anachronistic and atavistic spectacle in history is the spectacle of the modern intellectuals raising the primordial voice of the witch doctor, and in the midst of an industrial civilization, wailing about the hopeless misery of life on earth, the depravity of man, the impotence of man's mind, the ignoble vulgarity of material pursuits, and the nobility of longing for the supernatural. The echoes answering them are the voices of the plain medieval witch doctors that are beginning to be heard again, preaching the doctrine of man's innate preordained impotence, of humility, passivity, submission, and resignation. Here in New York City, the greatest monument to the potency of man's mind, and proclaiming that all the disasters of the modern age are man's punishment for the pride of relying on his intellect, for his attempt to improve his condition, to establish a rational society, and to achieve a perfect way of life on earth. On a recent television panel discussion, an alleged conservative intellectual was asked to define the difference between a conservative and a liberal. He answered that a liberal is one who does not believe in original sin. To which a liberal intellectual replied hastily, "Oh yes, we do," but proceeded to add that the liberals believe they can improve men's life just a little. Such is the bankruptcy of a culture. It is into the midst of this dismal gray vacuum that the new intellectuals must step, and must challenge the worshippers of doom, resignation, and death with an attitude best expressed by a paraphrase of an ancient salute, "We who are not about to die." Who are to be the new intellectuals? Any man or woman who is willing to think. All those who know that man's life must be guided by reason. Those who value their own life and are not willing to surrender it to the cult of despair in the modern jungle of cynical impotence. Just as they are not willing to surrender the world to the Dark Ages and the rule of the brutes. The need for intellectual leadership was never as great as now. No human being who has a trace of personal worth can be willing to surrender his life without lifting a hand or a mind to defend it, particularly not in America, the country based on the premise of man's self-reliance and self-esteem. Americans have known how to erect a superlative material achievement in the midst of an untouched wilderness against the resistance of savage tribes. What we need today is to erect a corresponding philosophical structure without which the material greatness cannot survive. A skyscraper cannot stand on cracker barrels, nor on wall mottos, nor on full-page ads, nor on prayers, nor on meta-language. The new wilderness to reclaim is philosophy, now all but deserted, with the weeds of prehistoric doctrines rising again to swallow the ruins. To support a culture, nothing less than a new philosophical foundation will do. The present state of the world is not the proof of philosophy's impotence, but the proof of philosophy's power. It is philosophy that has brought men to this state. It is only philosophy that can lead them out. Those who could become the new intellectuals are America's hidden assets. Their number is probably greater than anyone can estimate. They exist in every profession, even among the present intellectuals, but they are scattered in silent helplessness throughout the country, or hidden in that underground which in human history has too often swallowed the best of men's potential, subjectivity. They are the men who have long since lost respect for the cultural standards to which they conform, but who hide their own convictions or repress their ideas or suppress their minds, each feeling that he has no chance against the others, each serving as both victim and destroyer. The new intellectuals will be those men who will come out into the open and have the courage to break that vicious circle. If they glance at the state of our culture, they will see that the entire miserable show is kept up by nothing but routine and pretense, which disguise bewilderment and fear. Nobody dares to take the first new step. Everybody waits for his neighbor's initiative. If a society reaches the stage where every man accepts the feeling that he is a stranger and afraid in a world he never made, the world it gives up will be made by Attila. The greatest need today is for men who are not strangers to reality, because they are not afraid of thought. The new intellectuals will be those who will take the initiative and the responsibility. They will check their own philosophical premises, identify their convictions, integrate their ideas into coherence and consistency, then offer to the country a view of existence to which the wise and honest can repair. The new intellectual will be the man who lives up to the exact meaning of his title, a man who is guided by his intellect, not a zombie guided by feelings, instincts, urges, wishes, whims, or revelations. Ending the rule of Attila and the witch doctor, he will discard the basic premise that made them possible, the soul-body dichotomy. He will discard its irrational conflicts and contradictions, such as mind versus heart, thought versus action, reality versus desire, the practical versus the moral. He will be an integrated man, that is, a thinker who is a man of action. He will know that ideas divorced from consequent action are fraudulent, and that action divorced from ideas is suicidal. He will know that the conceptual level of psychoepistemology, the volitional level of reason and thought, is the basic necessity of man's survival and his greatest moral virtue. He will know that men need philosophy for the purpose of living on earth. The new intellectual will be a reunion of the twins who should never have been separated, the intellectual and the businessman. He can come from among the best, that is, the most rational, men who may still exist in both camps. In place of an involuntary witch doctor and a reluctant Attila, the reunion will produce two new types, the practical thinker and the philosophical businessman. The best among the present intellectuals should consider the tremendous power which they are holding, but have never fully exercised or understood. If any man among them feels that he is the helpless, ineffectual stepson of a materialistic culture that grants him neither wealth nor recognition, let him remember the meaning of his title. His power is his intellect, not his feelings, emotions, or intuitions. It is not the businessmen who have robbed him of efficacy, but those of his colleagues who have degraded his profession to the level of soothsayers, tea-leaf readers, and jungle oracles. Let him break with the neo-mystics. Let him realize that ideas are not an escape from reality, not a hobby for disinterested neurotics in ivory towers, but the most crucial and practical power in human existence. Then let him become an intellectual leader who assumes full responsibility for the practical consequences of his theories. The best among the businessmen should consider the function of wealth and realize that the power behind the incomprehensible evil now unleashed against them is their own. Wealth as such is only a tool. By renouncing his intellect, the businessman has placed his wealth in the service of his own destroyers. They do not need to nationalize his property. They nationalized his mind long ago. Let him now realize that practical action without a theoretical base achieves the opposite of his goals, and that intellectual irresponsibility is not a way of escape from his enemies. Then let him discover the function of philosophy. Instead of those ludicrous programs of student exchanges between America and Soviet Russia for the alleged purpose of gaining mutual understanding, there ought to be a private, voluntary program of student exchanges between the intellectuals and the businessmen, the two groups that need each other most, yet know less and understand less about each other than about any alien society in any distant corner of the globe. The businessmen need to discover the intellect. The intellectuals need to discover reality. Let the intellectuals understand the nature and the function of a free market in order to offer the businessmen, as well as the public at large, the guidance of an intelligible theoretical framework for dealing with men, with society, with politics, with economics. Let the businessmen learn the basic issues and principles of philosophy in order to know how to judge ideas. Then let them assume full responsibility for the kind of ideologies they choose to finance and support. Let them both discover the nature, the theory, and the actual history of capitalism. Both groups are equally ignorant of it. No other subject is hidden by so many distortions, misconceptions, misrepresentations, and falsifications. Let them study the historical facts and discover that all the evils popularly ascribed to capitalism were caused, necessitated, and made possible only by government controls imposed on the economy. Whenever they hear capitalism being denounced, let them check the facts and discover which of the two opposite political principles, free trade or government controls, was responsible for the alleged iniquities. When they hear it said that capitalism has had its chance and has failed, let them remember that what ultimately failed was a mixed economy, that the controls were the cause of the failure, and that the way to save a country is not by making it swallow a full unmixed glass of the poison which is killing it. The Founding Fathers were America's first intellectuals, and so far her last. It is their basic political line that the new intellectuals have to continue. Today that line is lost under layer upon layer of evasions, equivocations, and plain falsehood. Today's witch doctors claim that the basic premise of the Founding Fathers was faith and uncritical compliance with tradition. Today's Attilaists claim that that basic premise was the subordination of the individual to the collective and his sacrifice to the public good. The new intellectuals must remind the world that the basic premise of the Founding Fathers was man's right to his own life, to his own liberty, to the pursuit of his own happiness, which means man's right to exist for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others, nor sacrificing others to himself, and that the political implementation of this right is a society where men deal with one another as traders, by voluntary exchange to mutual benefit. The moral premises implicit in the political philosophy of the Founding Fathers, in the social system they established, and in the economics of capitalism, must now be recognized and accepted in the form of an explicit moral philosophy. That which is merely implicit is not in men's conscious control. They can lose it by means of other implications, without knowing what it is that they are losing, or when, or why. It was the morality of altruism that undercut America, and is now destroying her. From her start, America was torn by the clash of her political system with the altruist morality. Capitalism and altruism are incompatible. They are philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist in the same man or in the same society. Today, the conflict has reached its ultimate climax. The choice is clear-cut. either a new morality of rational self-interest, with its consequences of freedom, justice, progress, and man's happiness on earth, or the primordial morality of altruism, with its consequences of slavery, brute force, stagnant terror, and sacrificial furnaces. The world crisis of today is a moral crisis, and nothing less than a moral revolution can resolve it. A moral revolution to sanction and complete the political achievement of the American Revolution. Evasions, equivocations, and guilty apologies will not work any longer. The disgraceful injustice which penalized virtue for being virtue, which forced businessmen to apologize for their ability, for their success, for their achievements, has now been projected onto a global scale and translated into the disgraceful spectacle of America apologizing for her virtues and greatness to that bloody slaughterhouse of embodied altruism which is Soviet Russia. The new intellectuals must fight for capitalism, not as a practical issue, not as an economic issue, but with the most righteous pride as a moral issue. That is what capitalism deserves, and nothing less will save it. The new intellectuals must assume the task of building a new culture on a new moral foundation, which for once will not be the culture of Attila and the witch doctor, but the culture of the producer. They will have to be radicals in the literal and reputable sense of the word. Radical means fundamental. The representatives of intellectual orthodoxy, conventionality, and status quo, the Babbitts of today, are the collectivists. Let those who do care about the future, those willing to crusade for a perfect society, realize that the new radicals are the fighters for capitalism. It is not an easy task, and it cannot be achieved overnight, but the new intellectuals have an inestimable advantage. They have reality on their side. The difficulties they will encounter on their way are not stone barriers, but fog. The heavy fog of passive disintegration, through which it will be hard for them to find one another. They will encounter no opposition, since in this context an opposition would have to possess intellectual weapons. As to their enemies, they should comply with their enemies' request and leave them to heaven. The process of identifying, judging, accepting, and upholding a new philosophy of life is a long, complicated process which requires thought, proof, full understanding, and conviction. But there are two principles on which all men of intellectual integrity and goodwill can agree, as a basic minimum, as a precondition of any discussion, cooperation, or movement toward an intellectual renaissance. One principle is epistemological, the other is moral. They are not axioms, but until a man has proved them to himself and has accepted them, he is not fit for an intellectual discussion. These two principles are A, that emotions are not tools of cognition, B, that no man has the right to initiate the use of physical force against others. A. The first of these two principles represents one's basic rejection of the witch doctor's psychoepistemology. It means that one must differentiate between one's thoughts and one's emotions with full clarity and precision. One does not have to be omniscient in order to possess knowledge. One merely has to know that which one does know and distinguish it from that which one feels. Nor does one need a full system of philosophical epistemology in order to distinguish one's own considered judgment from one's feelings, wishes, hopes, or fears. Those who claim that they cannot do it are merely confessing that they have never learned how to use their mind and are incapable of perceiving, judging, or evaluating reality. This may be a psychological problem, but it becomes an intellectual fraud when such persons enter a philosophical discussion and demand consideration for their ideas. No discussion, cooperation, agreement, or understanding is possible among men who substitute emotion for proof. B. This second principle represents one's basic rejection of Attila's psychoepistemology. To claim the right to initiate the use of physical force against another man, the right to compel his agreement by the threat of physical destruction, is to evict oneself automatically from the realm of rights, of morality and of the intellect. Perhaps the most obscene legacy of altruism among modern intellectuals is their axiomatic acceptance of brute force and of somebody's sacrifice as a normal and necessary part of a human society, and their refusal to consider the possibility of a non-sacrificial, non-compulsory coexistence and cooperation among men. Observe that they cannot conceive of selfishness except in terms of sacrificing others to oneself, and they cannot conceive of anyone who does not regard such sacrificing as to his own interest. This, of course, is a psychological confession about the nature of their own desires and about the Attila in their souls. When they declare that they see no difference between economic power and political power, which means no difference between an employer and a hold-up man, no difference between the United States and Soviet Russia, they are confessing a witch doctor's abject fear of reality, which makes them equate a producer with an Attila. One would suppose that any man who makes claim to the title of moralist, humanitarian, or intellectual would spend his life trying to devise, as an ideal, a social system where no man or group of men may initiate the use of physical force against others or demand the sacrifice of anyone to anyone. But when one remembers that such a system was devised and did exist less than 100 years ago, one knows how to evaluate the brutes and thugs of the spirit who refuse to consider it possible. So long as men believe that the initiation of physical force by some men against others is a proper part of an organized society, hatred, violence, brutality, destruction, slaughter, and the savage gang warfare of group against group are all they can or will achieve. When physical force is the ultimate arbiter, men are driven to connive, conspire, and gang up on one another in order to destroy rather than be destroyed. The best perish, but the Attilas rise to the top. It might be understandable that primitive savage tribes could not conceive of a way of life without resort to physical violence, and the bloody chaos of tribal warfare was all they achieved, as those who remained on that level still demonstrate today. But when men propose to live in an industrial civilization by the moral concepts of those jungle savages, with nuclear missiles and H-bombs at their disposal, they deserve the catastrophes they ask for. Let no man posture as an advocate of peace if he proposes or supports any social system that initiates the use of physical force against individual men in any form whatever. Let no man posture as an advocate of freedom if he claims the right to establish his version of a good society where individual dissenters are to be suppressed by means of physical force. Let no man posture as an intellectual if he proposes to elevate a thug into the position of final authority over the intellect, or if he equates the power of physical compulsion with the power of persuasion, or if he equates the power of muscles with the power of ideas. No advocate of reason can claim the right to force his ideas on others. No advocate of the free mind can claim the right to force the minds of others. No rational society, no cooperation, no agreement, no understanding, no discussion are possible among men who propose to substitute guns for rational persuasion. If men of goodwill wish to come together for the purpose of upholding reason and establishing a rational society, they should begin by following the example of the cowboys in Western movies when the sheriff tells them at the door to a conference room, "Gentlemen, leave your guns outside." Those who will accept the basic minimum of civilization, the two principles stated above, will have made the first step toward the building of a new culture in the wide open spaces of today's intellectual vacuum. There is an ancient slogan that applies to our present position: "The king is dead, long live the king." We can say with the same dedication to the future: "The intellectuals are dead, long live the intellectuals," and then proceed to fulfill the responsibility which that honorable title had once implied. We the Living. This novel was published in 1936 and reissued in 1959. Its theme is the individual against the state, the supreme value of a human life, and the evil of the totalitarian state that claims the right to sacrifice it. The story takes place in Soviet Russia. The excerpt below is the speech of Kira Argunova to Andrei Taganov in the following context. Kira has been having a love affair with Andrei in order to obtain money to save the life of Leo Kovalensky, the man she loves. Andrei, an idealistic young communist who is profoundly in love with her, was beginning to discover the importance of personal values when, in the course of arresting Leo for a political crime, he learns the truth about Kira's relationship to both of them. No, you didn't know, but it was very simple, and not very unusual. Go through the garrets and basements where men live in your red cities and see how many cases like this you can find. He wanted to live. You think everything that breathes can live? You've learned differently, I know, but he was one who could have lived. There aren't many of them, so they don't count with you. The doctor said he was going to die, and I loved him. You've learned what that means, too, haven't you? He didn't need much, only rest and fresh air and food. He had no right to that, had he? Your state said so. We tried to beg. We begged humbly. Do you know what they said? There was a doctor in a hospital, and he said he had hundreds on his waiting list. You see, you must understand this thoroughly. No one does. No one sees it, but I do. I can't help it. I see it. You must see it, too. You understand? Hundreds, thousands, millions, millions of what? Stomachs and heads and legs and tongues and souls? And it doesn't even matter whether they fit together. Just millions, just flesh, human flesh. And they... it had been registered and numbered, you know, like tin cans on a store shelf. I wonder if they're registered by the person or by the pound. And they had a chance to go on living, but not Leo. He was only a man. All stones are cobblestones to you. And diamonds, they're useless because they sparkle too brightly in the sun, and it's too hard on the eyes, and it's too hard under the hoofs marching into the proletarian future. You don't pave roads with diamonds. This book is continued on Disc 3.